There is no doubt that the last worldwide pandemic that brought the world to its knees was the Spanish influenza, which began 100 years ago in 1918. That pandemic killed approximately 50 million or so people and eventually infected 500 million, which is about a third of the global population. That's an astonishing number of people. It makes the Black Death look almost like the common cold. In this week's episode of History with Brittany, we'll be talking about the deadliest pandemic in modern history so far, the Spanish influenza. Welcome to History with Brittany, the podcast that explores all things history. Each Wednesday, we'll discuss a historical topic, person, or event, and how it has impacted our world today. So without further ado, let's get started. Though the Spanish influenza claimed the lives of tens of millions of people across the globe, and perhaps even holds the distinction of being the deadliest pandemic in all of human history, we don't know what made this particular outbreak of the flu so deadly, despite our sequencing of the disease and the growth in our understanding of the flu and its effects over the last 100 years. There's still a fair amount we don't know about this particular outbreak. The Spanish flu, as it came to be known, was the result of the H1N1 strain of the flu. Does that sound familiar? It should. We actually had an H1N1 pandemic in 2009. Though scientists eventually determined that that strain of the flu had some different properties than the other initial strains of H1N1 we first saw. However, the world of science and medicine looked incredibly different in 1918. Though we had made great leaps and bounds in our understanding of diseases and how to treat various conditions, the world's medical community was still woefully unprepared for the outbreak of this disease and how it would rapidly spread around the world around the time the First World War was ending. In this episode, we'll discuss the history of the flu, the origins of the Spanish flu, how it spread in three different waves, the immediate aftermath, and how this pandemic affected our world today and what it means for the current coronavirus crisis. Part 1, The Flu in World History. Though the flu, as a disease, wasn't fully identified until the 1900s, specifically during the pandemic, as a disease, the flu has been infecting people for generations. Though it went by several names, the sweat, the Italian fever, or the gasping oppression, historians can mostly track the flu back to at least the 9th century, where a similar disease appeared to follow Charlemagne's army around Europe between 876 and 877. Though there were similar eruptions of this illness, it wasn't until the 1500s that the flu, as we know it, caused its first global pandemic in 1510 when it spread from Asia to Europe and Africa. One of the first records that we have of the flu was written on July 13, 1510 by Tomasino di Bianchi. He wrote, quote, "On this day in Medina, there appears an illness that lasts 3 days with a great fever and headache, and then they rise. But there remains a terrible cough that lasts maybe 8 days. And then little by little, they recover and do not perish," end quote. Though the disease he describes sounds remarkably like the flu, there was no real understanding of infections or how diseases spread on a microscopic level that left the Europeans able to dismiss connections between the various epidemics throughout the centuries. As a result, the disease had a variety of names and nobody was making the connection between them. But in regard to the 1510 outbreak, chroniclers at the time noted that it seemed to have infected every country, including the entirety of France, but had yet to reach the quote-unquote New World. The disease seemed to move in the same track as the Black Death centuries earlier, through trade routes in the east and the first infections being in Malta, then Sicily, before spreading to Italy proper. I did an earlier podcast on the Black Death where I described this method of transmission. Though there was some emerging understanding of how certain diseases target different groups, for example, smallpox only infects those that have not had smallpox, and syphilis only those that have had sex, the flu was noted as being indiscriminate. There's some question about the actual death toll from the flu in 1510. One contemporary, Francesco Moralto, notes that only about 1% of the population died, which isn't small by any means, but much smaller than the Black Death, where the death toll could be as high as 70 to 80% in extreme cases, and the Spanish influenza, where the death toll was about 10%. Influenza continued to have seasonal outbreaks throughout Europe from time to time, most specifically in 1557 and 1580. The reports about the mortality sound remarkably familiar, with the disease killing mostly the very young, the elderly, pregnant women, and the infirm, which we all consider aspects of the flu today. Though the flu was a nuisance that cropped up every now and again, that all changed in 1918. When the Spanish influenza spread, it crippled the world in a way that many likely thought was simply impossible. Part 2, The Origins of the Spanish Flu. Believe it or not, we don't actually know the original source of the Spanish flu or where exactly it came from. It was just suddenly there. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In history, as in many things, context is everything. In 1918, the world looked much different than it does today. Though transportation between the United States and Europe had been increasing, it was entirely by ship. The specter of the sinking of the Titanic, and most recently the Lusitania, still haunted the United States and Europe. The Industrial Revolution, which led to the building of these massive ships, also contributed to the development of the assembly line, and the recent release of Ford's Model T, the first automobile that was mass-produced and affordable for the general public. This led to the ease of transportation throughout the country. There were also some more practical and everyday inventions as well. For example, in 1913, most women were still using a corset until the invention of the bra. This is also the decade where the zipper was introduced, which drastically reduced the complexity of clothing. There was also the escalator, tea bags, and for those of you Java nerds out there, instant coffee. Basically, inventions were taking place every day that made life both easier and were changing how we thought of the world. In 1903, the Wright brothers were involved in their first plane flight, which in so many ways has utterly changed our world. The invention of the airplane has allowed us to both take to the skies on a regular basis, making traveling the world a snap, and led us to space just 50 years later. The airplane was also being used just 15 years later in the First World War. Since 1914, Europe had been embroiled in World War I, which reshaped the continent and took down many monarchies in the process. It started when Archduke Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated on a trip to Sarajevo. Due to that, and some other simmering tensions between various countries, Germany, England, France, Russia, and a couple others went to war. Yes, just over that. But again, there were some mitigating factors that deserve a podcast of their own. There's a book I read in grad school called The Persistence of an Old Regime. Basically, 30 years of war and revolution had wreaked havoc on Europe's economies, increased the desire of the people to overthrow the aristocracies in their respective countries and upend the social system. In fact, several ruling monarchies were quote-unquote relieved of their duties, including the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, the Italians, and most famously the Romanovs in Russia. It also led to the rise of communism. But again, that's another story for another time. Did America care much about this? No, not really. After all, the melting pot of the United States, at this point anyways, was mostly made up of people trying to escape that continent and its complex and historical policies. The country was also currently wrapped up within its isolationist policy, but this changed after the sinking of the RMS Lusitania in 1915 by a German U-boat. With Americans on board, it led to more calls for the United States to finally enter the conflict, though President Woodrow Wilson, an analytic and academic at heart, dragged his feet. It took 2 years, but the United States finally entered the First World War on April 6, 1917. By that time, the conflict was already reaching its inevitable, though utterly brutal, conclusion. World War I, in many ways, was the first quote-unquote modern conflict. It's where tanks, mines, artillery, trench warfare, machine guns, airplanes, and U-boats were used successfully in order to inflict the maximum number of casualties and destruction. After this, war was never the same. The war could also be considered the origin of the pandemic, because it was in the military camps throughout Europe and the United States where it spread unabated. Part 3, the pandemic. There were three waves of the flu. One in the spring of 1918, the most considered fairly mild and a rather normal season. The disease came back with a vengeance in the fall of 1918, with 3 months of hell in September, October, and November, before rebounding with another wave in the spring of 1919. Each wave was distinct and based around a variety of factors. To begin, let's start with the wave that began in the spring of 1918. The first wave. There are three possible locations where the flu originated. It was either the United States, England/France, or China. The flu, if you support the Americans as the instigators, was first in Kansas, with a Dr. Loring Minter reporting an unusual number of patients suffering from a severe form of influenza in early 1918. Which appeared to be circling in Haskell County. It wasn't long before many of those boys made their way to local army barracks as recruits for the First World War. On the morning of March 4th, Private Albert Gritchell wasn't feeling well. He reported to the Army's hospital at Fort Riley, Kansas, complaining of a sore throat, a headache, and fever. By the evening, 100 soldiers came to the hospital with the exact same symptoms. It wasn't long before the disease had spread throughout the country to other military facilities and prisons as men were preparing to join the war. The close quarters of the soldiers meant that transmission of the disease was quick, and as American troops headed to the front line, they offered both assistance to the Allied forces and brought the flu to Europe, if you believe the Americans were responsible. Of course, there are two sides to every story, or three in some cases. and the British liked to dispute this tale, instead arguing that the flu began in Estaples, France, at a military base where perhaps 100,000 soldiers could be found milling around. According to the report, the men were complaining of symptoms similar to the flu, like aches, pains, cough, and shortness of breath, and this disease likely claimed the lives of at least 40% of the men there. They then argue that it arrived in Oxford with a similar outbreak. Either way, the flu was spreading, and the influx of American troops who had the flu definitely didn't help. The other theory is that it was brought by the Chinese, who were used as laborers for the Allied forces. Some support this theory because it may explain why the flu season in China was mild. They were already immune. But as they worked with the Allies, it spread throughout Europe and to the American troops. That doesn't necessarily explain the cases in Kansas, though, so I'll leave that up to you to decide. With the arrival of the American troops, the flu was now officially in France. Soon it spread to the soldiers and general population. According to reports, between 125 to 250,000 civilians died, in addition to about 30,000 soldiers. The disease soon spread to the German front line and into neutral Spain. Obviously, the Spanish influenza got its name from Spain, but it didn't originate there, nor did it take an unusual number of lives. Due to the war, neutral Spain was the only nation really reporting on the emerging epidemic, due to British, French, and German authorities keeping a lid on the disease in order to avoid damaging troop morale. The Spanish king, Alfonso XIII, also contracted the disease and many senior political leaders. Many believe that it was a combination of all these factors that contributed to the 1918 pandemic of influenza being given the name, the Spanish flu, though the disease had nothing to do with Spain. Funny how that happens. I'd be curious to know what the Spanish thought or think of that. It's not really a positive distinction to have, especially since the disease didn't even emerge in their country. But that's the way the history books fall sometimes. Though the disease did not strike hard, the timing couldn't have been worse. The country and her people were struggling economically due to the fallout of the war and lack of trade, and the country was also socially divided, which likely contributed to the rise of dictator Francisco Franco only decades later during a bloody civil war. The mortality rate of the first wave was fairly mild and didn't raise too many eyebrows. It seemed like this was a normal flu outbreak that affected mostly the elderly, children, the infirm, and others who had health complications, and that all changed only months later. The second wave. When the disease resurfaced in the fall of 1918, it had mutated into something far deadlier. It had the ability to kill perfectly healthy young men and women within 24 hours of showing the initial symptoms. In a secret cable transferred by a U.S. Naval Intelligence officer on August 3, 1918, he wrote, quote, "I am confidentially advised that the disease, now epidemic throughout Switzerland, is what is commonly known as the Black Plague, although it is designated as Spanish in sickness and grip." Unquote. We don't know exactly when the flu mutated, but it was in England where doctors first started to notice that this new flu had mutated into something more deadly. And it was as the First World War was drawing to a close, soldiers were being shipped to Brest in France, Boston in the United States, and Freetown in West Africa, where the military acquired coal. Many were infected with this new strain, bringing it to new places. This rapid movement of troops, something that would have perhaps been impossible even a decade or two before, spread this disease throughout the world, and there was no one immune from its wrath. This rapid movement of troops, something that would have perhaps been impossible even a decade or two before, spread this disease throughout the world, and there was no one immune from its wrath. As we discussed earlier, usually the flu targets the very old or young and the infirm. This strain, which exhibited something called the quote-unquote W curve, resulted in a high number of deaths of those between the ages of 20 to 35. When people are supposed to be within the prime of their life health-wise, this was a complete shock, especially to medical professionals. This disease was so virulent that it killed about 195,000 Americans in just the month of October. These men and women also exhibited some rather unique symptoms, particularly nasal hemorrhaging and pneumonia. The victims would essentially drown in their own fluids from something called a guillotine explosion. This is when the immune system, especially in a young, healthy person, exhibits an extreme reaction to an illness, leading to inflammation and the death of the patient. It's like the body was working so hard to eliminate the virus that it killed itself in the process. Many medical professionals knew that quarantine was likely the best response to the situation, though for Britain that idea was especially difficult and mostly ignored since it would perhaps hinder the war effort. It is likely that we would find efforts to minimize the spread of the Spanish flu similar to what's going on right now in response to coronavirus. During the 1918 pandemic, Americans were advised to stay indoors, avoid shaking hands, wear masks, and avoid touching library books. Schools and theaters were also closed, just like today. What scientists have since found out is that those that were infected with the flu initially in the spring could still be affected with the second wave, but they were unlikely to die. Though the war was dragging on to its inevitable end with the official Artemis Day occurring on November 11th, 1918, the fight was far from over when it came to the flu. The third wave. Interestingly, the third wave didn't begin in Europe or the United States, but some suspect Australia was the origin before it spread around the world once again. The first wave was fairly mild and typical. The second wave was intense and deadly. And the third wave was a bit in the middle in terms of severity, but it lasted over a longer period of time. The third wave started in January of 1919 and continued through the spring or early summer, depending on the area. Millions were affected and millions died. The third wave is perhaps most famous for taking down members of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's administration before finally crippling the president himself. While traveling to the Paris Peace Conference, where the Allied forces were debating Germany's fate and possible payment of reparations after the First World War, members of Wilson's staff became infected, including several Secret Service members, his chief usher, and stenographer. Even his eldest daughter, Margaret, caught it, all recovered before returning back to the United States. It wasn't long before President Wilson became crippled by the influenza. According to his personal physician, Rear Admiral Carrie T. Grayson, quote, "These past 2 weeks have certainly been strenuous days for me. The president suddenly taken violently sick with influenza at the time when the whole civilization seemed to be in the balance," unquote. The president's advisors in Paris told the press that the president simply had a cold due to the chilly weather in Paris. There is no doubt that the president was gravely ill, barely able to talk or stand upright. Reports also exist that claim the president was likely experiencing some fever-induced hallucinations. For those of you that may or may not know, some people actually begin to hallucinate if their fever gets high enough. It actually happened to me once as a child when I had strep throat. The walls were moving and I had goofy hands. Needless to say, my parents were a little freaked. The timing could not have been worse. The Allied forces were discussing the possibility of Germany paying war reparations, most specifically to France, creation of the League of Nations, and Bolshevism. Some posit that his illness is actually partly responsible for World War II. Wilson was initially against reparations being imposed on the defeated Germany, but his abrupt changes after the flu resulted in them being ignored and rejected. The massive inflation caused by the reparations gave Hitler a foothold in his rise to power. It's possible that if Wilson had been well enough to attend the entirety of the conference during his time in Europe, things over the next 20 years could have been radically different. Another interesting footnote in history is that the future President Franklin Delano Roosevelt also contracted the flu. At the time, he was serving as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He, like Wilson, caught the disease in Europe, and when he arrived back in the States via ship, he had to be carried out on a stretcher. Though the third strain is the middle, more forgotten child in a way, this last wave may have truly changed the course of history. We'll never know how Wilson's presence at the negotiations would have resulted in a different outcome in the rise of fascism. There is no doubt that the Spanish flu really did change the course of history. Part 4, the aftermath. When it was all said and done, nearly 500 million people were infected. The final death toll ranges anywhere between 20 million on the conservative side and upwards to 50 million. Much is made of the losses in Europe, with 2.64 million dead, according to reports, and the United States, which lost around 675,000. But other countries and continents also suffered. In the Gambia, a West African country, entire families had completely disappeared. One British man, who saw the aftermath, wrote, quote, "I found whole villages of 300 to 400 families completely wiped out, the houses having been fallen in on the unburied dead, and the jungle having crept in within 2 months, obliterating whole settlements." In South Africa, about 4% of the population died. The Pacific Islands were hit especially hard with the disease, with the death toll in Guam about 5%, Fiji 14%, and Samoa 22%. Those are astronomical numbers when you think about it. The death toll was minimal in East Asia, specifically in China and Japan. Perhaps one of the most devastating locations where the Spanish flu occurred was in India, where 50 out of every 1,000 died. It also took an immense toll on native Alaskan communities, where the death toll could be as high as 70% in some areas. But of course, those that experienced the worst are often the same as it is now, physicians, nurses, and other medical professionals. During the time, the flu was a great burden on the medical system, which is already dealing with having fewer nurses and doctors on hand due to the war. Part 5, the legacy. For decades after the 1918 flu pandemic, no one had been able to sequence the genetics of the disease. In fact, when the disease was first spreading, some doctors questioned whether it was the flu at all because of the severity of the symptoms. That changed in 1951 when a Swedish scientist, Johan Olten, was able to gain permission to recover remains that might contain flu samples from an Alaskan village, where the bodies were kept fairly well preserved in permafrost. The village was remote, with only about 80 adult inhabitants before the pandemic struck. When the Spanish flu made its way there, 72 out of the 80 adult residents died. It's almost too horrifying to imagine. Unfortunately, though he recovered some remains, sequencing the disease was unsuccessful. Dr. Olten eventually tried again in the 1990s and was unsuccessfully extracted intact lungs from a woman named Lucy. From her remains, he was able to find and sequence the entirety of the Spanish influenza genetic code for the first time. Beyond the illness and the terrible toll it took on society, the Spanish flu encouraged physicians and medical researchers to continue looking to how diseases spread and the creation of vaccines, which were eventually successful. Today, we have both the flu vaccine and Tamiflu. One's a fairly effective vaccine, and the other is an effective treatment. My mother had the flu a couple years ago, and she said she took Tamiflu and almost instantly felt better. This progress in medical science is something we should celebrate, as it has saved millions of lives. And as a society, we have become very complacent. We haven't had to deal with a worldwide pandemic that is threatening the lives of millions of people in over 100 years. But now we have the coronavirus. Looking back on the Spanish flu, it's interesting to see how people were acting so similarly to the way we do back in 1918. There were many pictures of men, women, and children in masks, and the closing of schools, theaters, and even churches. Besides the style of clothing and technology, I think the people of 1918 and 1919 would be remarkably at home with us today. But I think one of the most important lessons we can learn from the Spanish flu and apply it to today with the coronavirus is that there will likely be a second wave, and we'll have less time to prepare because of the speed and ease of transportation. China, Japan, and South Korea, which all had a fairly good handle on the disease, are already seeing second waves. The real danger is that as the virus continues to spread, there is a higher probability of it mutating. If it does that, the second or third wave may be something far deadlier. Hopefully, that won't happen. And that is history. Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode of History with Brittany. I hope you enjoyed it and really learned something. And if there's a particular topic you would like to know more about or something that's of real interest to you, feel free to drop me a line on Twitter at History with Brit, 2 T's, Instagram and Facebook at History with Brittany, and more on my website at historywithbrittany.com. Next week's episode will be on the last days of the Nazi regime, which happened 75 years ago next week. Thank you all again so much for listening, and I look forward to meeting you again very soon.